Well, if you want to know about new religious movements, if you've got any time left from me fiddling with the things, please ask questions at the end. Or I have written a book, which I will flog, called New Religious Movements, A Practical Introduction. But the Inform office, and I will tell you about this, is going to be open on these afternoons, tomorrow, Monday. That's very out of focus, isn't it? Tomorrow, Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And it's in the St. Philip's building. And if any of you would like to go, it's St. Philip's North, at the end of a long corridor on the first floor. And you would be very welcome to go and talk to the staff there. I'll be telling you a bit about Inform while I'm talking. Yep. Oh, thank you, Barbara. The telephone number is 955 instead of 977. Yeah. This is really bad. Would somebody like to just pop outside and ask a porter to... would somebody sitting at the back mind very much? Just ask a porter to see if they could get audio vision. Thank you very much. You're not going to miss anything. What I'm going to talk about is my general perspective on social reality and what we're studying as sociologists and how this creates some problems for sociologists if they want to make some kind of difference and use the sociology that they're doing. And so I'll be talking about different ways in which it's a very sort of personal paper, have made a difference to the very things that I've been studying, both because for methodological reasons and for ethical and political reasons. And my sort of metaphor is going out into the marketplace where there are a whole lot of different constructions of reality which are competing to be defined as the truth or the most relevant picture of, in this case, the new religious movements. So the competitors that I'm going to be concerned with are the sociology of religion, the new religions themselves, the anti-cult movement, the media, the law, and therapists. And then I'll be talking shortly about some of the risks and apologetics involved in stepping outside the ivory tower, and then I'll be considering some meta-values. So that's generally the scheme of what I hope to be doing. Now, I take it that a lot of our problems in social science are due to the fact that social reality is difficult to cope with. That's better. Social reality is independent of the volition of any individual, and it's objective in that sense, in that it's something out there that we have to take into account, pretty well like we have to take a brick wall into account. We can't ignore it. We can fight against it, and we can try to change it, or we can just go along with it, or what have you. But it is out there, independent of any single one of us, that has to be taken into account. But it's also dependent on individuals for the perception. It wouldn't exist if there weren't individuals taking it into account and seeing it. So it's very subjective in that sense. And I think Berger and Luckman are quite helpful, and this isn't there. They wouldn't sink to anything as low as this, but this is my picture, based on Berger and Luckman's idea about the social construction of reality, where you have individuals who interact and they externalize their interaction. It becomes objectified into a social reality and then subsequently internalized. Now, I don't think you can see it very clearly, but there are lots of different colors of the social reality for all the individuals who are internalizing it. And the point here is that social reality is never completely shared by two people. There's always some sharing. If there weren't, then we wouldn't be able to have any society. Certainly we wouldn't be able to have any sociology of religion. And but there is never two people, even identical twins brought up with the same environment, see things differently because of their perspectives, because of their predispositions, their values, their hopes, their fears, their interests, etc. They actually see social reality in different ways. So that's quite an important, it's an obvious thing, but it is quite important. Another point is that social reality has properties. It can do things. Because you're working at a kind of group level, it can both constrain and enable the individuals. So it's more than the sum of the parts in that sense. We can do some things that we couldn't if we weren't, and the sorts of properties that it has differs very much according to the different situation in which we're in, the different culture, the different structure, the different kinds of organization and interaction. Now, if we could just go back a slightly simpler picture, the primary construction is this interaction between the people, and the primary construction that I'll be talking about is that of the new religious movement. But there are also secondary constructions. There are sociologists who are looking down sometimes at the primary construction and then creating a secondary construction. Or they might be talking to individuals or individuals who have left. But I want to make the analytical distinction between the primary construction and the secondary construction. But it's actually not like that, because I find it's extremely difficult to try and study a primary construction unless you actually get in there and talk to the people in such a way that it has an effect. So instead of that, I see it more like that, where the sociologists, those are the green ones. Can you see colour? Oh, good. Well, perhaps you've got a much better picture than I have. I've got a lousy picture sideways. The green ones are the sociologists. And they, with the orange line here, are actually contributing to part of the primary construction, affecting it and being affected by it, as well as making their secondary construction. But there are a whole lot of other people who are also making secondary constructions, the people I mentioned to you. And it's actually even worse than that, because the secondary constructions become muddled up with the primary constructions, and this becomes the primary construction of the cult scene. And the cult scene is where the marketplace that I want to talk about is concerned. So there are all these people with overlapping and different versions or constructions of reality, seeing this objective reality from different perspectives and contributing, making changes, because it's an ongoing process. It isn't a static structure. It's something that's continually going on and continually changing. Right, that's just the general introduction. Now, what about the new religious movements? The most important generalization that one can make about new religious movements is that you cannot generalize about new religious movements. They differ enormously from each other. They differ according to traditions. They come from Christian traditions. They come from Eastern traditions, such as Hindu, Buddhism, Shinto, Zoroastrianism, Islam, and from non-religious traditions. There are a whole lot of inputs, psychoanalysis, science fiction, there are all the UFO cults. So there's a very wide variety, and far wider variety than there was in the past, where you just had the 19th century sects, for example, that were mainly Judeo-Christian. I'm thinking of Christadelphian, Seventh-day Adventists, the Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, that lot. There were some other influences as well, but mainly you could tell roughly that they were very strongly affected by the Bible and were within that tradition, and they were far easier to classify and make generalizations. The kind of typology that somebody like Brian Wilson has made just can't be repeated with the enormous variety that there is with the new religions. The beliefs range from all sorts of hodgepodges to very well worked out theologies. You can have strange beliefs coexisting, such as reincarnation and resurrection in the same person. And sometimes there's a sort of Bible, as it were, holy scripture. Sometimes there are letters, sometimes there's nothing written down, but perhaps the guru or the master has produced tapes. Anyway, there's a very wide variety of beliefs and the ways that these are transmitted. Practices, rituals differ again. You might get liturgies, prayers, chanting, yoga, auditing with the Scientologists, meditating, animal sacrifice. Anything you can think of that's ever been done is almost bound to be found in one or other of the new religions. The membership varies enormously. The present wave of new religions in the West has been disproportionately from the middle and even upper middle classes. They tend to have been well-educated people of above average intelligence who've joined the better known movements. But there have been the poor blacks as well as the WASPs. There are people of all ages, though they've been disproportionately people in their early 20s or 30s. They come from all different ethnic groups, though they're mainly WASPs in the West, and from all different kinds of religious backgrounds, or indeed from no background, religious background at all. The size of the movements, again, varies enormously. There are very tiny little movements with a dozen people or so who interact face to face, like a family. And then there are the big multinationals, which have networks throughout the world. Leadership, that varies. Usually the founder is the leader, but not always. He or occasionally she may be seen as the messiah, as a prophet, as a philosopher, as a master, as a channeler, as God sometimes, with either a big or a little g. The organization varies again. It can be democratic occasionally. It can be bureaucratic quite often, it can be authoritarian, it can be totalitarian. Lifestyles differ. Sometimes people live in communities or communes. Sometimes they just live in semi-detached and you wouldn't know they belong to a new religious movement. Sometimes they work for the movement, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're aesthetic, sometimes they're hedonistic. They have very different practices according to all sorts of things like sex. Sometimes they're celibate, as with the Brahma Kumaris. Sometimes they go in for great sexual orgies, like Bhagwan Rajneesh's sannyasins did. Or you may have heard of the children of God, the flirty fishers, or hookers for Jesus, who would go out and show prospective joiners, converts, how much Jesus loved them, would have sex with them. They don't do that anymore, but they did in the past. Attitudes towards women, towards marriage, towards education, towards children, these are all totally different. Attitudes towards money, some think they should live in poverty, others espouse prosperity theology. As far as finances are concerned, some movements tithe their members, some go out fundraising in the streets, some have businesses, some ask for donations, and some sell courses, such as Scientology or most of the Human Potential movement. And as far as the effects go, these can be benign or destructive. Sometimes for one person, the same movement can seem absolutely wonderful and help them a lot, whereas it might get to near destroying somebody else. So what I really want to stress is that if you come up with almost any generalization, at least one of the number of new religious movements can say this isn't so. And although quite a few attempts have been made to categorize them, just if you take one or other of those particular variables, nothing else necessarily follows from it. There is this very, very wide range. As far as the numbers of new religions are concerned, this differs enormously according to the definition you use, and I'll come back to definitions later. But the definition that I use is that a new religious movement, and I admit that a lot of the movements are neither new nor religious, but they are, as far as I am concerned, if they appeared in their present form since the Second World War, and they're religious insofar as they address some of the questions that the traditional religions have been addressing in the past, ultimate questions such as, who am I, what is the purpose in life, things like that. On the Inform computer, we have somewhere between 1,800 and 2,000 different groups. Now, if you were to lump all the New Age together, the numbers would go down, and it includes quite a few movements which belong within the mainstream churches, which you might not count as a new religious movement, like the Neocatechumenate or some of the house churches, Opus Dei. But these are different movements about which we get inquiries. So we can't generalize, but I am a sociologist. So I'm now going to generalize. These are some of the characteristics that you can find in new religious movements. First of all, they tend at the beginning, and I have put new religious movements because they change, and very often people forget about this, but they do change, and they change far more rapidly than old religious movements, and that's obvious if you think about these characteristics that they must. Anyway, they start off, obviously, with a small size. First-generation membership. These are people who have converted. They have decided, even if, I'm assuming you don't go along with the brainwashing thesis, at least with the majority of cases, they have decided to join. So they're far more enthusiastic than people who have just been born into an old religious movement. They've been born again rather than born into. So they're voluntaristic, and all the things that are said about sects and have been true about new religious movements since time began are true about these because of their being first generation. And also because, or almost because they're first generation, they tend to have a very atypical demographic picture. I said that a lot of them, this is actually the family that was the children of God, and when they first joined in the 1970s in California, this is sort of fundamentalist Christian group, the ones that I was talking about who did the flirty fishing and don't anymore. They were mostly young people in their early 20s, so there were no children and no old people that you had to look after. Now, if you think what a movement like that is like compared to one which is 20 years later, and again, this is the family. They've got masses of children, and the people who joined in the 70s are now getting middle-aged, and there are actually very few people. So it's almost exactly the opposite of what it was 20 years ago. And I'm not going to go into details, but if you just think about it, you can see that that will make a lot of difference to the movement. And then after a few more years, it'll be fairly normal distribution that you'll be able to see. So, atypical representation of the population. They very often have a leader with charismatic authority. That means a leader who isn't bound by either rules or tradition and can tell people exactly what they should do over all aspects of their life, perhaps whom they should marry, where they should work, where they should live, what kind of clothes they should wear, what kind of toothpaste they could use, all manner of things, and this is without question. Now, of course, it doesn't always work like that. In fact, it doesn't usually work like that, But compared with, say, the Pope or the Archbishop of Canterbury, you do find that the kind of authority they have is slightly different. Their beliefs tend to be very much unqualified. You haven't got the accommodation that you've had over various centuries or generations, at least, of questioning new group, new generations coming along. They tend to be painted in primary colours rather than in greys. It's very clear what the truth is. And there tends very much to be a sharp distinction between them and us, and before and after. The them and us idea tends to be, this is what Mary Douglas would call a strong group situation. Them are satanic and bad, and we are good and godly. They also tend to have sharp distinctions between before and after joining the movement, and you'll often hear people witnessing, and there's what I call the bum to saint conversion. You know, I was a miserable sinner, but then I got converted, and now I'm a little angel. And there are these people who didn't hear when they were told the truth, and so they're starting to be little devils. And then with the more millenarian groups, they're waiting to go up, and they're among the elect and saved, whereas the others are among the damned. Or at least that's one scenario. There's another scenario for the coming of the Age of Aquarius with the New Age movement. That's when everybody was fighting, as they are or have been in the past, and the scorched earth, and there's always thunder. And then the Age of Aquarius is going to come along, and everybody's going to be happy, and the sun's going to shine all the time, and it's going to be lovely. So there are very extreme differences. Okay, well, that's a very rough and brief introduction to the new religions. But what I'd like to do now is jump on to describing some of the ways in which I have found that I have been making a difference. It seemed to me absolutely necessary to go into the new religions if I wanted to study them and do participant observation and live with the movements. And when I was studying the Unification Church, I became aware that it made quite a big difference in a lot of subtle ways, not an enormous difference, but a very noticeable difference, just the fact that I was there, because they were a very sharp them-us boundary. And here was somebody in an ambiguous situation crossing this boundary. I used to try and avoid the leader of the church whenever I could when I was staying there. But occasionally I'd meet him on the stairs or something, and he'd come up to me and he'd say, "Hello, Eileen, you're either with us or against us, you know." And I'd say, "No, I'm a value-free objective social scientist." And we had a kind of joking relationship and kept this up for a long time. But various people did find it some uncomfortable and some sort of quite unsettling that there was somebody there. But others said that it actually made them feel more relaxed. And one girl actually left, and she went to King's, I'm afraid, rather than to LSE, but she told her supervisor that she had left because through my presence, and not my saying anything to her, and the sort of outlook that I had, which was neither with them or against them, she realized that perhaps she could go out into the outer world and do something, a degree that she wanted to do, and not feel that she was rejecting everything that had been good in the movement and going into a satanic world, but that there was some kind of middle way. So the point I want to make is that just by being there and crossing a boundary in a very close-knit movement, you can make a difference. And then being there as a professional stranger, again, you make a difference because people can talk to you as perhaps the only person you can talk to. It's not just meeting somebody on a train and telling them all your life or your sex history or something, which sometimes happens, because you know you'll never see them again. It's actually developing a sort of relationship and having a role where people can come and find you and speak to you, because they know that on the one hand you won't go to the Sunday sport, but on the other hand you won't tell the leaders or anybody else in the movement if you've got problems, and you can try and sort them out, not by my being a therapist, but just by my being somebody to whom they could talk. Now, that might sometimes have the effect that people would then feel free to leave, as in the case I mentioned before, but sometimes it actually relieved the situation for them. So again, just my presence was, and of course this isn't just me, it's anybody else who's done any kind of participant observation, has this. And there's a kind of consciousness raising, because we go around and ask all these impertinent questions. And this works both at the individual and at the group level. At the individual level, just to give you an example, I was staying in one of these places where you can go and work with a whole lot of academics in luxury for a month or so. And I was working on a questionnaire for a New Age study I was doing, and I asked the other academics if they would mind filling in a pilot questionnaire for me. And I asked them, there were several couples there, and I said to them, please don't confer until you've filled it in, because I'd like to talk to you in order to check through for the pilot. And the next morning, one of the men came to me with his questionnaire, and he said it was one of the most traumatic experiences of his life, having filled in this questionnaire. And I was absolutely amazed, because it seemed to me a pretty anodyne questionnaire, in fact rather boring. And so we went off, and I got my tape recorder out, and after a bit he burst into tears, and he said he'd really been upset because he realized now that a whole lot of the questions that he had had to answer were ones that he had suppressed, and that for a long time he had been leading a lie by living in a community which had a certain set of beliefs, and he was going along with them. And so we discussed this, and then I went off, and his wife came along, and again I went into another room with her and my tape recorder, and she said it was the most cathartic, exciting, wonderful experience she'd had for ages. So I said, why? And she said, well, it was just amazing. I haven't really addressed these questions, and now I feel released. I've been living in this community, etc., etc. So she'd gone completely the opposite way, but had exactly the same experience. I suggested that they got together, and that evening they came and they said that they'd had a wonderful afternoon laughing and crying and felt this terrific release, and it had made an enormous difference to their understanding. Now, what happened after that, I don't know. I still get Christmas cards from them, and this was about 6 years ago. Another couple was quite interesting. Again, they filled it in separately, and the outcome of that was that I learned they had never actually talked about these sorts of questions to each other before, because one was a Catholic and the other was an agnostic, so they assumed that they would be different, and they'd been married for about 30 years and just felt, oh well, she or he thinks in a different way from me. But when they compared their answers, they discovered that they practically deviated not at all. So that was something else that was, I still don't quite know what to do with that, when that sort of thing. I mean, what does it mean for my study? And what if it had gone the other way and I'd been getting divorces left, right and centre? It's a worrying thought. Anyway, I just want to give that as an example of how consciousness raising, or one Mooney once put it to me as, after an interview by me, he felt that he had taken all those things that he had been stuffing into the pending tray for ages, and had to look at them. And that's, I think, what we do when we go out and we start asking people all sorts of questions that have been lurking in the back. Also, it can work at group level. To give another example, I was in a temple, I think it was Philadelphia, somewhere like that, Hare Krishna temple, staying there. And I'd interviewed a lot of people separately, and then I asked if some of the women devotees would actually spend a day with me, where they would discuss what it was like being a woman in Krishna consciousness. And it was amazing, again, because they had never heard each other's points of view and their feelings and this built rage that came out about how the male devotees were treating them. And the one person who didn't do this till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon was the school teacher, who was socializing all the kids into behaving like women, girls, or boys. And they turned on this poor woman. Anyway, her consciousness was raised pretty damn quick. And all sorts of things happened, I gather, after that, including changes in the schooling. And I wasn't terribly popular with the male devotees in the Philadelphia Temple for some time, but I think I've been forgiven now. But again, that's just another example of the sort of way in which you can be doing things just by methodologically asking questions. Now, there's also a whole lot of ethical and political differences. The first one I've got down there, mediating, that's not quite so obvious. I mean, I found I was doing that almost as part of my methodology when I was studying the Moonies and then later other new religions, in that I would also study parents and talk to them. And often they didn't understand what their kids were up to, and the kids were not understanding, these are adult children, let me stress, didn't understand their parents' point of view. And just by doing some sort of translation, very often this made a difference in the relationship between parents and their children. Then, of course, as we all know, once you start writing and going into the public domain with television, radio, and what have you, you are putting forward your secondary construction to other people and challenging other people's expectations, visions, versions of the new religious movements. Once you go into the courts as an expert witness or you write affidavits, again, you are making a difference to the outcome of cases. And then I just want to talk briefly about Inform. I know some of you know, in fact, Barbara's here and actually worked for Inform. But please forgive me for those of you who don't know about it. If I tell the others. Inform, I set up with a very definite political, ethical move. My road to Damascus, as it were, came, perhaps I should say that when I was at LSE, this is in parentheses, in some of our methodology courses, I remember being told very much that you weren't meant to make a difference. You were meant to be removed and objective and not muddy the waters or mess it all up. Not everybody thought that, but I thought that sounded a good idea. I'm now dead against it. I've changed my mind completely on that, methodologically, and I'll come back to this in a minute, politically. Anyway, I was at an anti-cult meeting, and what happened was that they had an four ex-members of different movements who were talking to parents. And the person who had collected these people hadn't done their homework very well, because they were saying that they'd had an interesting time there, they'd now left, but it was an experience which they didn't entirely regret. And some of the people there started saying, oh, you're lying, you were brainwashed. And they said, no, we weren't brainwashed. And they said, well, we were deceived. And they said, no, we were told what we were letting ourselves in for. And then they were told, well, you're deceiving us. And there was absolute bedlam. I was sitting taking notes. And then somebody tried to pour oil on troubled waters and said, why don't you try and say something that would be helpful for the parents who are here? And a woman got up and started screaming hysterically, we don't want to hear this. We don't want to hear this. It's all lies. And I stopped taking notes. I thought, they don't want to hear this. They just want to preserve their picture, their version of reality. I knew some of these ex-members, not all of them. And they were honest people who were saying what their experience was, but it had to be redefined. So I thought, something's got to be done. So, to cut a very long story short, I got the support of the mainstream churches. Bob Runcie was Archbishop then, he was very helpful, and then the Home Office, David Mellor, gave me start-up funding for 3 years for Inform. And what we do is, it's housed at LSE, as you know, it wasn't originally, but we try and provide information that is as accurate and balanced and up-to-date as possible about the new religious movements. We try to put forward our construction of reality rather than some of the competing constructions of reality. We do this by answering questions that come to the office directly or through a large international network of scholars and other experts, doctors, lawyers, counselors, etc. We put on seminars, day-long seminars on various subjects. We get about 70 to 100 people. Things like children in new religions, the law in new religions, authority independence in new religions, leaving a new religion, changes in new religion. We had a couple of years ago over 200 people at a four-day conference on new religions in the new Europe here. And there were 23 different societies, if you count the Vatican, who were present talking. And we had some members, representatives of six new religions. We invited the anti-cultists to come, but it was only the foreign anti-cultists who came. We were banned by the ones in this country. We give talks. We've had special groups for therapists to learn about problems that they might encounter looking at people affected by new religions or their families. And we have various support groups, etc. Now, we don't have a magic wand, obviously, but I really do believe, and I think a lot of people would agree with this, that we have helped quite a lot and made quite a big difference in the cult scene in Britain, but not only in Britain. I'm doing a lot of work in Eastern Europe at the moment, and the battle's going on there over various things in America and other parts of Europe and elsewhere. People are trying to set up and inform. At the moment it's unique, but there are some small groups that are trying to set up something similar to inform. We're used by parents, by the media, the government still uses us. They used to use some of the anti-cult groups, but they use Inform the whole time now, and a whole lot of the police, social services, all sorts of people. Anybody can walk in off the street and use us. Now, I would have expected, but I didn't realize how much setting up Inform would be placing something that was a real competitor in the marketplace of secondary constructions. And the response was really vitriolic. The anti-cult movement and certain sections of the media seemed to switch all their resources from attacking the new religions to attacking Inform in general and me in particular. And some of you may have seen me being slain on television or in the radio. I was the villain of the week one week for Face the Facts and all sorts of extremely unpleasant things. There were questions in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. There's an MP whose name I won't mention, because unlike him, when he says things about me in the House of Commons, I'm not protected by parliamentary privilege. But if he were not protected by parliamentary privilege, all our financial problems would be solved with one fell swoop, because I could sue him for his lies. Anyway, I had to go and see Douglas Hurd and then Waddington, and there was a petition to 10 Downing Street. I had a terrific fuss. But actually it was quite helpful, except for being unpleasant. It's not anything I would offer to any of my friends. But the Home Office did decide to give us another 3 years funding, and it's under consideration at the moment whether they're going to give us some more. But as you know, they're not exactly throwing money away at the moment. And so it's tight, but still. Anyway, that is in form. Now, if I could move to the marketplace. Now, I'm sure you're not going to be able to read all of this, and it doesn't matter terribly, because all I have time to do is give you just a tiny idea. I think I probably could involve it and do it up a bit more. But what I'm trying to do is, it's a bit of sociology of knowledge, really, is to say that there is this variation in the ways that people see and construct secondary realities, and people's perceptions are never shared. But the differences are, to some extent, at least systematic, and they rest, at least in part, on the interests and the aims of both individuals and groups. And these six groups all have very different aims and interests. I don't know if I can zoom this up a little bit. If anybody's really interested, I can give them copies. Can you read that at all? No. Okay. It's just going out of focus. Oh, that's a focusing thing. Ah. Is that it? Oh, I wish I'd discovered that one before. Well, how do I get bigger and lesser? Oh, I'll leave it there. What it says is, these are the interests and aims, these are the methods, this is the way they select data, and what they include and what they exclude, means of communication and relationships with sociology of religion. Now, I haven't got time to go through it all, but my main argument is that because we have different aims and interests, we exclude and include. Nobody has the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's impossible. But even social scientists, we don't get the whole truth. We include and exclude certain things, and we have to do this. It would be no good if I was trying to explain to the parent of a Raelian, for example, what Raelians did just using the language and representing, reproducing Raelians, because the Raelians have already done that and their parents haven't understood what the heck they're talking about. You have to translate or interpret. And an example I've often used is, it's rather like an actor playing a bore on stage. You can't be boring if you want the person to understand better what it's like to be a bore. Similarly, if you want to get it understood what it's like to be a member of a new religious movement or what they're up to, you've got to do some sort of translation, interpreting. But you've got to do that, if you're a social scientist, according to certain rules. Now, there are certain things that we exclude. We, first of all, have to exclude any question about, such as, is it of God? Anything theological. Sorry about that. We have to use methodological agnosticism. We have absolutely no way of saying whether God is an independent variable or angels. I mean, people will say, I converted because God or the Holy Spirit entered into me. Or the anti-cultists will say, it's the devil who's doing all this. We just have to say, we don't know. And recognize that we have no way. We're in empirical science. Secondly, values. The world is cut up, the values, in very different ways by different people. One of the questions we're continually being asked at Inform, and I'm always being asked by the media or anybody I talk to, you know, is it a bad thing? Who are the baddies? Who are the goodies? And of course, as a social scientist, I can't say. People cut up the world into moral and immoral and non-moral in very different ways. There is no single way. Somebody else will see something in a very different way, what is moral and not moral. I don't have to stress that point. We, as part of our meta-value in sociology, think that we have to be objective and value-free. Of course we never are, but we try to be. That is our value. Now, I've talked about values a bit. I'd just like to start, and I'm going to change this later, but say that the basic meta-values are that we should be value-free in our research, that's in the analysis and production of secondary constructs. But we can bring our values into choosing what we consider is worth studying, and think that, you know, somebody ought to know something a bit more about this, and also in the use that is made of our secondary constructs. I don't see why values shouldn't enter into that. Of course, we've also got in our data the primary constructs. They have values, but this is value as data, so it doesn't affect us. It isn't part of the meta value. So I'd like to suggest that's where we start from. Now, the next thing, apart from values and supernatural things that we have to exclude, are making definitions about what something really is. And one of the questions that keeps coming up when people phone in form is it a genuine religion? And we have to say, well, it all depends what you mean by a genuine religion. Because conceptual boundaries are necessary. We need to call something a religion or not if we're going to communicate. But it's arbitrary where we draw the lines. So for one person, we will find that religion is quite widely defined, and it overlaps with politics and economics, say. Another person will define religion very narrowly, so that it may still overlap or it may not. Anyway, there are a whole lot of different ways in which you can do this. And the number of battles that are fought over definitions is really quite interesting. It's one of the most important areas in which there are battles in the cult scene. Let me just read you a transcript, or at least a sort of annotated transcript, about a conversation I had with somebody, a woman. She was actually an academic historian who'd had a son join the Unification Church, the Moonies, and she got very irritated with me because I referred to the Unification Church as a new religion rather than as a cult. And she said that I was giving it some sort of respectability by doing this. So I explained that cult was used technically in the sociology of religion, and it wasn't a cult in that sense. And that although it was used in popular parlance, that always had very negative overtones, and that I would prefer to add my evaluation after giving a description rather than just sort of automatically assuming it was bad by giving it this negative label, although I didn't actually approve of quite a lot that went on in the Unification Church. But she just kept on saying, well, it isn't a religion. So I said, well, the members believe in God. And I challenged her to produce any definition that she wanted, because I didn't think she could produce one which the Unification Church wouldn't fall into. And then she said, well, it's not a religion, it's political organization, it's big business. And so I asked about the Catholic Church, and I knew she was a Catholic, and I said it was involved in politics and had businesses and shares, and did that stop it being a religion? And she said, of course not, that wasn't the point. It wasn't a proper religion because there was all these strange beliefs about Eve having sex with Satan and Jesus meant marry and what have you. So I then asked her if she believed in the tenets of Islam, and she said, no, of course not. So I said, well, is Islam a religion? And she said, yes, but it's not like the Unification Church, or it's not like the Moonies, it's genuine religion. So I said, what's the difference? And she said, well, it's been around for millions of years. So I said, well, if the Unification Church had been around for a bit longer and it managed to get a few million more believers, would that make it a religion? And she said, heaven forbid, no. So I said, well, what would make it a religion? And she said, nothing would, it's rotten to the core. Now, that was her point. It couldn't be a religion because it was bad, and religion and bad had to go together. Now, sometimes you get the opposite. A lot of people think that religion is bad, so they don't want to be associated. And a lot of Christians will say, well, I don't belong to a religion, because they think that's just a sort of boring old church or something. And so it can work anyway. But there are a whole lot of secular reasons why the boundaries are very important, and how it's defined does have a whole lot of secular consequences. There are a whole lot of very interesting sleights of hand that go on in the marketplace, some of which are quite funny. I remember once a university chaplain told me that we can't call the Hare Krishna a religion. So I said, well, are ordinary Hindus a religion? And she said, yes, but they've already got a room. And I must have looked a bit nonplussed, because he then went on to explain that the university had a rule that each religion should have a room, but there weren't enough of these to go round, so the cults who claimed to be a religion couldn't be defined as a religion, otherwise they'd have to start sharing, and that would lead to all sorts of problems. So somewhat naively, I suggested that it might be easier to modify university rules than to redefine the Krishna devotees as members of a non-religion. And his answer was, but that would be religious discrimination. Sometimes there are really millions of dollars that can hang in the balance, whether something's labeled as a religion or not. For example, the Church of Scientology has fought successfully in Australia and America to be labeled as a religion, although they don't believe in a god. And a lot of people would say that they're not, but if now they can get tax exemption. Brian Wilson has listed a whole lot of characteristics, and he comes just down on the side of Scientology being a religion. But it does depend how you define it. And conversely, transcendental meditation has fought and actually lost in the courts to be defined as not being a religion, because according to the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, if you're a religion, you can't be taught in the schools or in state things like prisons, and they want to be able to do their give their techniques of meditation in these places. So it's not just, you know, sort of nitpicking. If we start to say real definitions, etc., then we are getting into trouble, or there are enormous consequences. We also include a whole lot of things that... that goes up over there. The most important thing, and I'm not going into this, because if you've all done some sociology and been to LSE, you know all about control groups for testing correlations and the wider context. But it is actually very important that we do that, because one of the differences between us and some of the other secondary constructions, like the media, for example, they can tell perfectly true stories of things that are going on. And if a cult is included, you get a lovely headline like cult member commits suicide or what have you. But they don't have to go and check how many Methodists of the same age and background have committed suicide. And you never see a headline saying Methodists commit suicide. So the point is that the cult committing suicide, cult member, becomes far more visible, and there's no balance. And therefore, part of the way that the sociologist has to put, what the sociologist has to put into his or her description is something far more, that is, how many people of similar age and background who are Anglicans, Methodists, or what have you, have this happen to them or do something or the other. Now, the anti-cultists are very like the new religions in a lot of way, but they're the other way around. They tend to be very them and us and drawing sharp boundaries, except it's the other way around. They've got the sort of satanic and unnatural evil, them, are in the cults, whereas the rest of us are comparatively undifferentiated and sort of natural or normal and different. The media, their interest, of course, is to get a good story and keep readers, viewers, listeners, etc. They will go to people who can give them the good story. They're not going to go to somebody who sees their moony daughter every second Sunday, or tell the story about Krishna devotees doing good things or what have you, or just the ordinary, the normal. They're not of interest. They want something really exciting and not normal in their constructions. There's a kind of circularity that goes on. Again, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time, but very often the anti-cultists will feed the media stories. The media use these, and then the anti-cultists will take the story to prove that it is now true. And this can happen. I remember on one occasion they fed a whole lot of stories for a television program about me, and then they wrote up the review in the Anti-Cult Journal saying that I had answered all these questions, and it looked as though, you know, I had got an answer, and but one did have to ask why the questions had been asked in the first place. Now, obviously, there's no smoke without a fire, but they'd actually kindled the fire. They produce it, and the very fact that they have produced it can help to create this version of reality. And they also tell ex-members who will be used by them and by the media to prove certain things. But they may have taught the ex-members. There's quite a lot of work showing that people who leave a movement, if they've been in touch with the anti-cultist, if they've been deprogrammed in particular, learn that particular kind of secondary construction of reality, and it gets reproduced. And so the anti-cultists, having taught during the process of getting the person out of the movement that they were brainwashed, exploited, etc., will then produce what they have taught the person as proof that this happens. And those members who don't go through this process have a very different version of reality. The law, they obviously want to win for their client, and so everything tends to be very much black or white. And if we are trying to appear as impartial and balanced, I rather naively thought I would give the same answer to the questions, whatever I was asked. Of course, you're not allowed to do that. First of all, you can't choose what the questions are. But they very soon get to know you as an unreliable or a whore witness. And so it's very difficult to get a balanced and objective view across in the courts, just because of the way that they are defining the agenda. And to a certain extent, it's the same in the with the media. We need the media to help us, and a lot of them do help us a lot in getting our version across. But there are a lot of problems with this. I put in the therapists because I think probably some of you heard Mike Hill talk, but there's been work done by people like Cheryl Mulhern, who's actually here, and other people like Jean LaFontaine, showing that they can help to create a reality for their client. Now, if they're just doing that to some extent to help the client get better, that's fine. I'm not talking about all therapists here. But when they go out into the courts or to the media and say, this is the reality, then you can get gross distortions. It is 5:30. I'm sorry, I have miscalculated this. Let me, I won't do all the mea culpa things. But let me just finish off by going back to this meta-value thing. What I would like to argue is that when we enter methodologically into the data, we have to take this into account. But this need not affect our meta-values. And even when we use our secondary constructions in the competitive marketplace, that I think we may do without destroying the meta-values. But sometimes, for a number of reasons, because we're under pressure, because we can't control the questions, we get pushed in a number of ways where it's very difficult to preserve our meta values, and these get squiffed by us going out into the sort of general supermarket. And this, I think, is a dangerous thing, and some of us are very much aware of the problems and are looking at this and trying to do something about it. But in the end, I would argue that for an accurate, balanced account, the logic of social science is infinitely superior to that of its competitors. Thank you. Are there any questions? I mean, the rest of you can go, obviously. But if anybody does want to ask questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yep. Om Shinrikyo. Yeah. we've got quite a lot of information about them at Inform. I suggest you go to Inform if you want details about their belief and stuff. I won't go into that. I met some in Ukraine. They've been faxing us stuff and sending us stuff from New York since this happened. I did see them in Japan some time ago. But about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in Kiev and saw some of them there. And they're still saying that we're Buddhists. We wouldn't kill anybody. It's impossible. And a lot of people are very, very, I mean, a lot of the members are very, very upset about what's happened. But obviously, it's horrific. But it would be too long to go into very complicated belief system, but if you'd like to go to Inform, they can show you some of the books and literature. Yep. Yeah. It's sort of pyramid selling. That's very much a verge of whether you call it a new religious movement. But again, we have got stuff because we have been asked. Well, why not wander across to Inform? Because no, I don't think I can really. I mean, I don't want to. What, sorry? Yeah, the phone number of Inform is 955-7654, but it's open in the afternoons. It's open now. It's just across the road. But I want to be true to my secondary constructions of reality being objective and balanced. And it's not a movement I have studied in detail. I mean, as we know, it is pyramid selling, and there's enormous pressure put on people, and then the people down at the bottom of any pyramid tend to do badly, but that's nothing particularly to do with new religion, except that there is overlap with some of the ways in which pressure is put, sort of emotional blackmailing and greed. But yes. Yes, I was using very shorthand and behaving rather badly in that sense. It's a very wide range of groups that includes worried parents and at one extreme and the deprogrammers at the other. Deprogramming, for those of you who don't know, is illegally kidnapping somebody and holding them against their will until they renounce their beliefs. No, that's by definition. There's also exit counseling if you want to make that distinction. But by deprogramming, I mean using illegal force. And it's not an exaggeration that it happens. It happens, has happened a great deal. And people have been held against their will. I mean, there's masses of evidence for that. It's no exaggeration whatsoever. So that's the extreme, and of course there's an enormous amount of money involved in that. People have charged tens of thousands of dollars for this, and it has got some... parents are usually involved in it, but there are professional deprogrammers. There are some in this country, but it doesn't happen. Who pays? The parents pay. And they will usually do it because they are told that the parents will be lucky if they see their child again, otherwise because they will have been brainwashed and under mind control. And one reason why they don't like sociologists' constructions of reality is, and indeed the cults don't, or the new religions don't like it either, because we say there's a very high turnover, which there is. I mean, the majority of members of all the well-known new religions leave within a couple of years of their own free will. But the anti-cultists don't all go in for deprogramming by any means, and a lot of them are very against it. But it certainly has been carried on in this country quite a bit. That's the extreme. Yeah, there was somebody behind. Well, it all depends what you mean by mind control techniques, but I would say that I find that very difficult. They certainly put enormous pressure on people to join and to stay, as indeed a lot of the older religions. In fact, they're more effective if you're born into a religion. I did a study of the Moonies in the 70s, and I looked at 1,000 people in the London area who were interested enough in the Unification Church to agree to go on a residential workshop where the so-called brainwashing, mind control, was taking place. And this was around the time of the Daily Mail case, and everybody was saying irresistible, irreversible techniques. And what I found was that over 90% of those were perfectly capable of saying, thanks very much, we don't want to be a Moonie. And those who did join the movements, the majority left within a very short time. And then using a control group, I looked at those who joined, those who went to the workshop and didn't join, and an ordinary population of similar background and age who had nothing to do with the Unification Church at all. And my sort of weaker hypothesis about brainwashing, the first one was, well, if it was irreversible and irresistible, everybody would have to join, of course. But when the vast majority didn't, the next one was, well, perhaps it's those people who are particularly suggestible or weak. And what I found was not that it was the Moonies who were particularly suggestible or weak by a whole number of independent criteria, but it was a small group of the people within the workshop who went and either didn't join or else became a member for a very short time and then left. Now, there have been a lot of other scholarly work doing looking at this, and we all seem to come up with the opinion that there is always the possibility of saying no. Of course, it's very easy to be tautological. If somebody's joined, then they must have been brainwashed. And then you're told you don't care if you look at the 90% who leave and say, well, you know, there must be something special that these people find attractive. But I believe that nearly always, not necessarily always, but nearly always, the person thinks they're getting something out of it and are colluding in some way or other. And certainly, most sociologists of religion who have gone and studied what's going on there would agree with that, and the rates would suggest this. But having said that, there are a lot of ways in which very great pressure is put on you to join and stay. You know, both carrots and sticks. There's deception used, which I would differentiate from brainwashing. A lot of the movements lie through their teeth and hide things. Sometimes this gets found out and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they use emotional blackmail. Sometimes people confess things and this is used against them. Sometimes they either have independently some sort of strange experience or one is induced. There are quite a number of fairly easy ways of getting you to have a strange experience. And this is interpreted by the movement to prove that they are right or not. And if you accept that, then you might think, oh, well, you know, this is the Messiah, this is the way to build the kingdom of heaven or what have you. Sometimes you get into debt. You might sign a contract for a billion years or something with the Scientologists. But people do leave. I mean, that's a fact, that they can leave. So I prefer not to just have a sweeping statement like mind control or brainwashing, but to look at the actual processes that are going on, because they're not all the same. And very, very rarely is physical coercion used. The results may seem the same from the sort of things that went on in prisoner of war camps with the Koreans or the Chinese or Bettelheim stuff. But the actual methods are very different. You don't start from being locked up. You go there because you think you're going to get something out of it. Now, some people will argue that that makes them more effective. But, you know, I think you need to look at each particular case and each individual. And if you just produce a blanket phrase like brainwashing, then you don't understand what's going on. And if you want to help somebody get out of a movement by making them more aware of what's happening, then I think it's counterproductive to use that sort of language. And I think also that a lot of people actually do go get something out of it and want to stay in there quite definitely, who aren't being deceived or under any very great pressure. Yep. This is another three lectures. I think there are a lot of different factors. I mean, I think one of the most important things is just the pluralism. There's now a lot of geographical and social mobility. We don't have the same experiences of life that our parents have. We tend not to be in the same jobs. We don't live in the same place, so we don't necessarily accept the old religion. Authority is questioned through the family, breakdown or whatever you like, change anyway. In education, you don't just accept authority. The media undermines authority. And there's a stress on individual finding your own thing in the supermarket. The media produce the possibility of seeing a whole lot of other possibilities. Kids being in school with people, immigrants, you know, realize even if they go on accepting their own Christian beliefs that they were brought up in, will know that other people don't. There is a relativism introduced. Travel, people going to other countries. That all these things work together. The gurus coming, for example, I think it's 1965, 8, I can't remember, when the immigration law in America changed, a whole lot of people came from the East with their religions and brought those introduced. Numbers, it's very, very difficult. I would say that the number of people who are in a new religious movement in the sort of strong sense that they commit their whole lives to it at any particular time isn't that large. A large number have gone through them and learnt quite a bit. But a lot of people don't sort of think of themselves as being part of the movement. But there are a whole lot of ideas, particularly new age ideas, for example, or ideas about reincarnation that are in part carried by the new religions, that are part of the general cultural milieu, or this sort of great big supermarket where people can go along and try things. But there aren't more than a few hundred fully committed members of any of the well-known religions. You know, there are people who are sort of associates or hangers-on. I mean, there are a few hundred Krishna devotees who devote their whole lives, but there's an enormous Asian population that uses the temple and goes to the festivals, just as they would, you know, if there were other Hindu temples and festivals going on. They don't see it, and Sai Baba the same. There are a lot of people who might feel some sort of affiliation or sympathy with other movements but don't want to be fully committed. In the sort of human potential and New Age groups as well, people go shopping around. I mean, you might go to Findhorn one week, Glastonbury the next, St. James's Piccadilly, the next, go pagan dancing, fire walking, look at your crystals, go and get a channeler to tell you what to do. There's, you know, people are not fickle, but you can do a whole lot of different things if you're in the scene and you go to the Festival of Mind, Body and Spirit or Predictions Festivals or something and swap around. So there is far more on offer. But at one point I did try to do some sums of the number of people who had left the mainstream churches. I think it was between 1975 and 85. And I added those up, and then I added up what seemed to me a reasonable number of people who were committed to new religions, and it came to 4%. So people are doing all sorts of other things. It's only one of the options. I mean, other people, I've got a PhD student at the moment who's doing football, belonging football as a new religious movement, using the same sort of analysis. Somebody the other day asked me if I'd supervise one on fashion. I mean, there are a whole lot of different ways in which some of the tools and ways of looking perspectives could be switched round, like some people look at Marxism as a religion. So it's really messy. But that's my answer to your question. It's the pluralist society where all these different things coexisting. But nothing, I mean, some come and go. But it, I think it's, you know, division of labor, social, geographical mobility, mass media, etc. Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, unless you happen to be a nun or a priest. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right, it does. Yeah, I think one of the most potentially dangerous situations in new religions is when people do leave touch with the outside world, because then it's only the movement that is defining reality. So you get situations like Jonestown or Rajneeshpuram or New Vrindavan, where people are socially and geographically cut off from the rest of society. But lots of groups, the Amish, the Hutterites, monasteries, convents and things, have had the same sort of cutting off, detachment, and it's seen in very positive terms. You know, people want to devote their lives to God, and this is how they're going to do it. And they're not necessarily stuck in because of that, but it does happen the way you're describing it, certainly. And if it is a them, us, and particularly, I mean, perhaps with the sort of Om Shim Rikyo, if one of the versions that we're hearing is correct, that's the most horrific way that it can proceed. But, I mean, something like Waco, I blame the FBI for that. It was absolutely crazy and absolutely unnecessary. And the scholars in the States were desperately trying to get to, and it was the anti-cult movement that was feeding you, this is what you have to do. I mean, like a big deprogramming, as it were. Now Janet Reno has actually set up a whole lot of social scientists to get advice and things, realizing that it was madness. But they were a cut-off. And you see, it's not only that they see us like that, we see them like that. And one of the things that we do in Inform is mediate with the movements. And most of them, not all of them, I mean, some of them won't speak to me. One's threatening to sue me at the moment because of something I wrote. In fact, there's a letter in my room which I haven't read, which is the latest installment. but most of them do agree to see us because they know that we'll be fair. On the other hand, I've been to the police and reported things, you know, as well. If I discover that people are doing something that I think ought to be dealt with, as an upright citizen, I'll pass it on to the Home Office or what have you. But generally speaking, they do trust us to try and see their point of view, at least. And they do open. I mean, the family approached me, having been absolutely impossible to get hold of for years. And now I've stayed in their places in, I think, about 12 different countries, actually. And I don't say in advance when I'm going, necessarily. I'll turn up, and I've been allowed to meet with the top leadership and all sorts of things, which a lot of the members still can't, because they are anxious. And this is another problem, because then we're in danger of being used, which is okay if we're just putting forward a reality of our version, construction of reality, which is nearer the truth than the other ones. I think probably most social scientists, insofar as they do get biased, or is kind of reaction to the anti-cult movement rather than protection for the new religious movements. But when we see what we consider to be gross violations of human rights being carried out, then, or very untrue things being said, some of us do get very angry about this and might go over the top sometimes and putting the other point of view. But actually, when they're not being attacked, then we come in and attack them. And we can attack them to their face, and they do give money back. Do make arrangements for their children to get in touch with families again and do all sorts of things like that if they have been cut off. But very often they'll say, well, we're afraid of deprogramming. So we say, well, we'll guarantee as much as we can this will not happen. If it does, we'll make a fuss, we'll go to the courts, etc.
Yep.
What? Yes. I've gone blank. Yes. Somebody help me. I mean, second leaders, I mean, usually are non-charismatic. And the present head of Scientology, I would have said, was decidedly uncharismatic. Definitely. But I just can't think of one at the moment. No, I wouldn't. And of course, it all depends what you mean by charismatic. Sort of charismatic authority, I was talking more in the sort of Weberian sense, and quite often, I mean, in a funny way, Moon isn't charismatic in the popular sense. I once wrote a paper called Charismatization, because when people first see Moon, and most of the Moonies hadn't seen Moon when they joined, find him pretty repulsive. But they learn through peer group pressure to see him as something very special that they will accord charismatic authority to. And I've got a PhD student who's just finishing something on Sarge Yoga, and she's found exactly the same process going on there with Divine Mother. Somebody help me. I can't think of any. Oh, well, I suppose the leaders in Brahma Kumaris aren't particularly charismatic. I can't even think what comes now. Rail is charismatic. Another question while I think. Sorry, this is a blank of me. I've had a long day. Yes. That's another six lectures. Enormously. I mean, in 89, when the wall came down, the new religions were there and they went rushing in. and they're selling their wares left, right and centre. Not mainly religious wares, quite often they're selling secular wares. You know, English lessons, travel to the West, all sorts of other things, business skills, etc. And just giving literature out as well. But there are enormous battles going on because of this sort of vacuum. It isn't as much of a vacuum as you'd think. And the economic situation is mainly so big that people are putting it in the pending file. The mother churches are getting very hot under the collar about what's going on and are worried, and everybody turns to the cults as the scapegoat for the things that are going wrong in the religious scene, not generally speaking. And that's getting quite ugly in several places, very ugly. The ones who are far more successful than the cults are the American evangelicals, who have enormous money and influence and building churches left, right and centre. In some countries it's very difficult to go for more than a few miles without seeing a new church, Seventh-day Adventists, the Baptists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons. They're not building churches, of course, but it's changing the whole time. There are a few indigenous new religions or old religions. Something that's quite interesting, it's very much tied up with nationalism, the battle, and of course the international organizations are seen as being betrayers, and rather it's treason rather than heresy. You know, you're not a real Bulgarian or what have you if you don't belong to the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox Church is are particularly in Armenia. They've just had some pretty awful things happening in parts of Russia as well, Romania. I've lost my line of thought. But there are, oh yes, what I was going to say is that there are an interesting growth, not a vast one, but a little bit of pagan religions which are pre-Christian, going back before the Christian invasions came, which is part of the nationalism thing as well. That's another thing. Yes, sorry. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and that's also tied in with the whole creationism, evolution debate as well. It's been going on for a long time, which is fascinating. What's happening in the world, in the Eastern Europe at the moment, is that it's desperate for any kind of literature. And the Moonies came in, and they have written two textbooks on morals. It isn't anything to do with divine principle, directly anyway. The unification theology, and they've got these and they've distributed them to schools who were delighted, a lot of the local education authorities, to get these books which presented a moral point of view, because there's a moral vacuum and it's a very great problem teaching children. And then it was discovered that these were Mooney books, and there's now a big reaction against this, and they're trying desperately to get them removed from the schools. So that's one thing that's happening. Yeah. Yep.
What kind of methods do they have to accomplish this paradigm?
Well, conversion's a funny thing. There's usually some.
I'm a recent convert myself.
Oh, right. Oh, well, you're a funny person. I mean, my brother converted to Catholicism, and he was
up.
You were forced into it, yes. Well, I mean, my brother was quite hopeless for about 3 months, but he sort of gradually became normal again. Conversion can help, can work in a whole lot of different ways, and you have to take the individual, their experience, how much they're seeking, what they're seeking, what is available, what they see is available, how it's presented, a whole lot of different things. Sometimes it seems to happen like that. Oh, I wouldn't say that social science has ever made any claim to go beyond a very limited empirical understanding. I mean, it, as I was saying, we have to be methodologically agnostic, and I would hate anybody to think that I thought social science dealt with ultimate questions. In fact, I was trying to say that it doesn't, but that doesn't mean to say it's not very useful, and it can at least show up some things that are untrue. I'm not in competition with God. No, I wouldn't. Yes. Sorry? Dea Gloria, yes. Yes, they used to be at Bromley, they've moved now. Kenneth Frampton's thing, yes. Yes, I would put them into part of the counter-cult movement in that they are strong evangelicals and they have their truth that they wish to promote, and they believe that other movements or other beliefs are wrong. So they're in the sort of theological competition very much so, yes. It was set up by Kenneth Frampton, whose two sons joined the Children of God. One of them is still in, I know him quite well, and the other one left. He's dead now, but he's, Kenneth Frampton is. No, they won't have anything to do with me now. I did have in the old days, but I'm off their mailing list. There's quite a nice woman called Joy Caton who runs it, but I've invited her to inform things. I gather that she feels that they're rather polluting, which is a pity. Sorry, can you speak up? Well, I was just using that as a metaphor of people who construct versions of the new religions from a different perspective, using different methods because they've got different interests. And the competitors that I was generalizing about, and I didn't have time to go into details, were the movements themselves who produce a version of what they're like, the anti-cult movement who selects all the bad things and rejects all the good things and get very annoyed if you try to balance. One person once phoned up an editor of it was a Catholic journal that I'd written in, saying that Eileen Barker's article was so objective and balanced he demanded the right to redress the balance. And Lord Rodney, who was the chairman of FAIR, one of the anti-cult groups, used to meet with me quite often and say he didn't disagree with any of the facts that I said. He was charming. He used to take me to tea in the House of Lords. He was one of the few people who'd speak to me. But he said that I muddied the waters because you had to have a clear message. They are bad, they do 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said, well, sometimes they do, and on the other hand, stop it. You can't get your message across. The media, who I mentioned briefly, the courts construct sort of black-white according to a particular interest. They will rule out as an inadmissible evidence some things, even though they might be relevant to the court case. Therapists have another interest and therefore produce another version. Theologians I could have brought in. I mean, I can expand this quite a lot of way. And they will ask questions that the social scientist can't answer. But they will also, and that, if they're dealing with God, fine, that's a different ball game, as it were. But if they're saying that the Moonies take drugs, that the Brahma Kumaris have sex orgies and things. That's just not true. I mean, there might be a Moonie who takes drugs, but it certainly isn't part of... I can tell you some other things about the Moonies, but not that. So my battle, as it were, or social scientific battle, which is difficult because of some of the reasons I hinted at the very beginning, we all see things according to our interests and different perspectives. But I do believe that the logic of social science, which, well, as we're in the LSE, let me talk about refutability, we will go and say certain things are not the case, minimally. And we will try and put things in a perspective, as I gave the example for the suicide. You know, it might be that more non-cultists are committing suicide than cultists, in which case it's only a correlation, we don't know why. But we might ask, what is it about the new religions that prevents people from committing suicide rather than forcing them into it? So that's the competition is in giving anybody who's saying that they're giving an accurate and balanced account of reality is in competition with us. I don't know it. Great. Healing. Oh, there are lots of healing movements about masses. I have been healed of all sorts of things. I've subjected myself to, I can't tell you how many healings. Unfortunately, I've still got a disc missing and lack of control over the right leg and various other things. But I love doing some of the meditations. No, healing is big business in the traditional as well as the new religions. Some of the things can be quite dangerous, I mean, physically dangerous, quite apart from the fact that you might not go to Orthodox. But other things, I think, you know, particularly the more psychosomatic stuff, the alternative medicine can be terrific, really good. It's very popular. I mean, we couldn't possibly cover all the healing things that are about. Extraordinary number. Alternative medicine and stuff. But I don't know your particular one.
That is a religious
Yep. Purification. Yep. No, there's masses. Right. I have a dinner appointment at 7:15, so thank you very much for being so patient with me.